Welcome to another episode of Open Science Radio. It's the number 170. This is Konrad Förstner. Today is the 7th of June 2019, and as usually, with me is Matthias Fromm.
Good morning.
Hello. But we are not alone, but again, we have a very special guest with us, Peter Kraker.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for the invitation.
Hi, Peter. Or Peter, how we would say, you know, in English. But okay, I hope everybody understands both ways here. Peter, we invited you to discuss with us because you have kind of an initiative running, or a kind of something like this running, and we try to bridge into this direction. But I would say before we get into the core topic, I would like to ask you to introduce yourself a little bit. I guess many people, many listeners of us are or know you very well due to different activities that you drive in the open science scene, but maybe you can give a small introduction of yourself and what you're doing usually.
Sure, yeah. So I'm the founder and chairman of Open Knowledge Maps, which is a visual interface to the world's scientific knowledge. And before that, I was a senior researcher at NOW Center of Graz University of Technology. And throughout my career, I've been basically an open science advocate. I'm still very interested in shaping this whole ecosystem. So I'm part of the Open Science Network Austria. I'm also part of GoFair and other initiatives that try to drive open science forward.
Mm-hmm. And in March of this year, you gave an interesting talk at the Open Science Conference in Berlin, where we were also as well. And you basically have this initiative, Don't Leave It to Google. I guess before we have to dive into that, we have to discuss a little bit what is actually happening in science, or what is kind of scientific, or what is research infrastructure? Should we maybe dive into this, that people better understand what the whole topic is about? So what is research infrastructure?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I guess there are many definitions out there. For me, I'm building on top of this definition that was formed in the RISCAPE project of the European Union. And essentially, I think it's our facilities, resources, and services that help researchers and other stakeholders to conduct research. And I'm mostly talking about digital infrastructures. So that's then things like software, digital tools, services, platforms, or simply collections of digital research outputs.
Mm-hmm. And what is now your problem, if you say it like this? So what is the issue? So I think everything started with a new tool from Google. Maybe you can start there. So this started roughly in September of 2018. What happened there, and what is your problem with that?
Yeah, so in 2018, Google launched a new product called the Google Dataset Search, and it's basically a search engine over datasets that's cross-disciplinary and works in a similar way to Google Web Search or Google Scholar. And since we're also doing discovery at Open Knowledge Maps, dataset discovery was also important to me for quite a long time. And when Google Dataset Search came along, I suddenly started hearing voices within the open science community and outside. Well, now Google is going to fix this problem that we have, that datasets are not really findable and that they are not reused properly. And, you know, there's now an entity that will do just that. And that's when I got a bit worked up, because Google is doing discovery. There's no doubt about that. But they're doing it in a closed and proprietary way. So you can use for example, Google Scholar and Google Datasets search, but you're not allowed to reuse or republish the results. As soon as you, for example, trying to programmatically access Google Scholar, you're immediately shut out. And so that's why I think that for an open science, Google Dataset search is not the right solution.
Mm-hmm. So in principle, they are doing a good thing. Basically, they make data sets discoverable. I think you talked also about this dark knowledge that exists basically in science. Maybe we can discuss this a little bit afterwards. But in principle, it's a good thing. And yes, maybe Google is doing this the right way, but technically the right way. But the issue is that the reuse is not there. It's not possible. And that this is kind of hampering in long term the community with that, right?
Yes.
So what are the current alternatives? Or what were the alternatives and what are the alternatives today, if you think in this direction, before Google came and tried to make this accessible?
Well, I think for that, I'd like to take a quick look at how we're doing it with publications right now. Mm-hmm. And I think if we look back into history, about 15 years ago, the first digital search engines came along, and Google Scholar was one of them. And in the beginning, they were really good at making publications findable. But since then, the scientific knowledge has doubled twice. So we have now four times as much research outputs, as many research outputs as we did back then in 2004. And for this kind of amount of knowledge, the systems and the interfaces, they didn't keep up, right? And this wouldn't be a problem if we could now build on top of, for example, the Google Scholar Index. But since Google shuts you out, there is no way of creating innovative systems or interfaces or user-facing services on top of Google Scholar. And thankfully, a different kind of infrastructure emerged, an open infrastructure, to which many of the public libraries, institutions, researchers, and also a lot of the publishers actually contribute to. So there are libraries and repositories and aggregators that take all this knowledge and then offer open interfaces to or open data interfaces to their indices. And this then enables everyone to build on top of that and drive discovery forward. And I think we need to do the exact same thing for data sets.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think is this not properly done so far?
So at this point, I think a lot of the funding is mainly towards backend infrastructure and things like high performance computing and other things. And they're all very important. Don't get me wrong about that. But essentially, not a lot of funding and not a lot of thought so far was given to this kind of discoverability and findability of data sets. But going forward, this, of course, will be an important issue, especially cross-disciplinary, because most of the problems that we have in today's world, they can only be solved cross-disciplinary. And so I think that the attention of policymakers and funders really needs to go towards these areas.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that actually the people with the highest pressure for action or the biggest reason to change direction are the funders, or where are other stakeholders or players that should change their current behavior?
So I think that money is always important. Right. And in the way that funding schemes are formulated and in the way that projects are selected, this really shapes how the infrastructure turns out in reality. And so right now we see that the backend is always more important than the front end, and also the evaluation often doesn't take into account how user-friendly a system is, how well it is designed. And I think this really needs to come to the foreground. So that's why I see the biggest burden actually on the funders. Mm-hmm. But I would also say that the infrastructure providers also need to take interfaces and user-facing services better into account. Because the way researchers interact with their system really determines whether the infrastructures are being used or whether they are not used. And therefore, I think there needs to be a collective switch, a collective change, in that we acknowledge that this is important. And this is the only way we can really get the open infrastructures to the researchers.
Mm-hmm. I'm just coming back, or I just came back yesterday. It ended the DRSE conference, the German-speaking or the German Research Software Engineer conference. And one topic there is, or one issue there is in general that was discussed for infrastructure is the funding schemes, right? And the issue that mostly projects are funded, let's say 3, maybe 4, maybe 5 years, and then it stopped, and the infrastructure still needs to run. Is this also an issue that you see here for this in this topic?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is something that really needs to be solved, because there is no continuity in funding. And the problem with the project-based funding is also that they are usually looking for new systems, right? And if you have already an existing system that works well and that is being used, it's very difficult to get sustainable funding for that system. And moving forward, if we really want an open infrastructure, reusable infrastructure, we need to solve this problem.
So this means it's even getting a problem or a task for politics, because the funders, they have their clear mission. For example, DFG can only do project funding. This would mean somebody else would have to step in, or these funding schemes would have to be changed, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that funders should be allowed to shave off a certain percentage of their funding pool, and then support existing infrastructure with that. But I also think that it's not only funders that need to step in. I think also research organizations, they need to understand and acknowledge that their buying decisions really factor into this, and that they also need to invest into the open infrastructure. And lastly, I also think that in general, this mindset, that there needs to be a certain mindset switch, and that we need to understand that it's not always the new shiny object that needs to be funded, but rather also the existing, working, well-accepted infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's often the case that the infrastructure is only appreciated when it's not there anymore, right? Or when there's a small outage that you suddenly recognize, oh, wait a sec, this seems to be something important to me, and I just take it for granted. I mean, also regarding funding, maybe bring this in here as well. The option of a foundation was discussed, like NumFocus, for example, for, let's say, this Python universe, I would say, or the scientific Python computing community. Would you accept something like this as well? Would you think this would be something that would be a solution for the funding issue, a foundation?
Well, I don't think that it's a long-term solution, to be honest, because I think foundations are an important part of this whole ecosystem, and they certainly are funding really good initiatives. But we shouldn't forget that they also have a certain agenda, they have a certain program, and the commitment in taking long-term funding and long-term maintenance for infrastructures should lie with public actors and public organizations, I think.
But it could be, let's say, a new foundation exactly with that aim, and then different research organizations could pay into that a certain share, and by this could support it. This would be, I guess, the idea, not that you build on existing foundations that do not have that aim so far.
Well, yes. I mean, for a certain time, I also thought that this could be a possibility. Mm-hmm. But in the real world, we see actually that the distributed schemes, these are the ones that are working. Like, for example, SCoS, the mm-hmm. Global Sustainability Coalition for Open Science Services, they are asking their membership organizations and consortia of research organizations and libraries to each provide a little bit of funding to mm-hmm. different initiatives. For example, for the OHA, this worked very well, and they could double their budget within 1 year. And it also means that they're not reliant on a single entity, right? They are now mm-hmm. funded by more than 100 organizations. And that also means if there is a certain drop-off of single organizations, it's not that big of a problem, other than when you're funded by maybe one foundation and they decide to drop you, then it's probably goodbye at this point. Mm.
Okay, and leaving this topic of funding a little bit behind us, who else in the system could help make this better infrastructure happen? Who can drive the change into, let's say, this closed to this more open, or to strengthen this open infrastructure? Who else would be required to do something different than it is doing now?
Well, I think there is a lot of willingness among the different infrastructures to work together and to collaborate. And I think we really need to build on top of that. And that's why we have started an implementation network within GoFair that addresses exactly this point. And it brings together a lot of organizations that are already champions of open and fair data, such as, for example, DataCite, EU.DAT, OpenAIR, and others. And collectively, we will be now creating a plan on how to create this ecosystem and this infrastructure for dataset discovery that's open and reusable. Mm-hmm.
And would you also see the option that further participants can join you, basically, if other people think, okay, this seems to be a good initiative and we have we could have our share in that? Would this be also a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a very open group. It's also in the beginning phases. So I think now would be a very good time to join. And you can do so by going to the GoFair website and then look for the Discovery Implementation Network. And there you can find a contact form, which includes all the required information. So we're very happy and willing to accept new members.
Mm-hmm. And will this be a collaboration or a consortium, or however you would call this now, mainly on the political level, or will this be also on a technical level? So will code be shared and together be implemented? What kind of level is this aiming for?
Yeah, definitely we're aiming at the implementation, at the technical implementation level, but we want to do so in a very inclusive and really good approach by taking into account the user side as well. And we're starting now out with the user stories and the use cases for this infrastructure. And on the other side, we're matching it with the existing tools and the software that's already out there. And from that, we want to create an architecture of this system and then understand which of these, which parts of the infrastructure we want to implement first and which ones maybe come later. So this is really a call to interested researchers, experts in discovery, infrastructure providers, tool makers, a wide range of stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So this is the one side. And on the other side, of course, we also want to affect change on a policy level. And it will be important to talk about these infrastructures and why we need them and so on. So this will be, I think, part of the implementation network, but the focus is really on getting the infrastructure, the technical infrastructure on the road.
Mm-hmm. Do you have already a timeline here or a roadmap, or is it still in the early phase that you're mainly collecting potential members or still trying to put the ideas together?
So I think this year we want to consolidate the network and understand how the architecture would look like, and also identify those pieces that we want to implement or connect, and then next year, hopefully, get funding for the different parts in order to be able to really implement them.
Mm-hmm. One question regarding these implementation networks, because if we look at the website of GoFair, we can see that there's a number of implementation networks either already active or being in like the preparatory stage or even the stage before at least interest is being shown. And I assume that a number of them have kind of a similar goals. For example, you as the discovery implementation network are working around the discovery of scientific knowledge or scientific data. I assume that something like Cooperas, which is another implementation network, has also at least a facet of discovery in it. Is there some interactive or inter-collaboration in between these groups?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm now also part of the executive board of GoFair, which acts basically as an interface between the steering committee and the implementation networks. And since we want to provide kind of the cross-disciplinary and across domain discovery interfaces, I think this is a very good position to get all this input from the different implementation networks. But even apart from that, there are implementation network meetings. So one was the first one was in Leiden in January of this year, where we all get together and try to understand how we can work together and reuse each other's work. Because that's also very important to me personally. I don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? I want to take what's already there and then add value to that.
Hmm. How's the relations to other broader initiatives, for example, on the global level, the Research Data Alliance, that has also a number of working groups coming together in plenaries every 6 months, if I'm not mistaken, and who also have working groups focusing on like the infrastructure aspects?
So the way RDA works, they come up with recommendations and standards and things like that. This is what we want then to reuse when we're building the infrastructure, right? So RDA does have some budget also for implementing prototypes sometimes or using recommendations in practice. But I think the way they have designed this now is that in RDA, the standards are developed and the recommendations are developed, and that GoFair then takes them and implements them in real-world infrastructures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I also think it's really important, and I'm really happy that these different initiatives work together on a very high level to understand how we can collectively bring this forward. Because I don't think it's very useful now that there is some sort of competition that breaks out between people and organizations and initiatives that essentially want the same thing.
I think that might have been one of the fears when we were actually talking about one of the greater stances in Europe, the European Open Science Cloud, as being part of the infrastructural backbone for the research organizations in Europe, that this might even raise competition within the different infrastructure providers that have been existing up to that point. But I think now we see more of an understanding that several entities can actually participate on a wider level in these in these phases where it's necessary to look at all the perspectives from various stakeholders and come together and bring them together and find the core aspects that are important for everybody to kind of design a solution where everybody can participate in or can benefit from or at least has some interest in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from history, we've learned that these systems usually thrive when you can easily plug into them mm-hmm. and be a part of them and provide something innovative for them. And if they're not kind of controlled by some big entities that basically do everything or set the kind of decide who's in or who's out. So I think that's a very good direction that we're seeing there, but we must be always be very aware that the EOSC is basically what we make of it as a community. And so I think we all need to get involved and all need to make our voices heard, that we want an EOSC that is inclusive and participatory, that is open, and that really enables new players to easily come in, while also having very strong stances on open infrastructures and no monopolies and no lock-in effect and things like that.
Maybe I'm a bit ahead with this question, but if we look at initiatives such as GoFair, can you actually see that industrial or let's call them commercial vendors of infrastructure that can be used for research purposes as well look into activities or initiatives such as GoFair and kind of want to either participate or at least see what's going on and then react upon of what's discussed there?
So I definitely think that the work should be very transparent that's being done in there, right? We're working in an open science, and open science is always also about transparency. So I think that should always be there, but we should be very firm in that we don't want closed and proprietary infrastructures to start dominating this space again, right? I don't think it necessary always has to be linked to kind of the legal entity that is behind a certain infrastructure, but it tends to be the way that commercial infrastructures are more proprietary and more closed than the ones that are run by nonprofits or public entities. So I wouldn't preclude them, but they really need to commit to this kind of reuse and openness.
Which would be actually a model that, I mean, there are examples where this would work out, but clearly it's not very common. But we see in general maybe more of a shift in this direction, that even commercial entities see themselves more as a service provider, in that sense that they help developing this stuff, the infrastructure, but have to do this in an open fashion, right? And cannot rely on the investment that they make and then just harvest the outcome of this, but that they are, well, providing a service, establishing that, and then are done with that job, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that could be a good business model for some of the commercial entities out there. But it's definitely not the model that works with, for example, venture capital. Because with venture capital, you always need to create something that generates a loss in the beginning, but through locking the people into your system, you then create basically a single winner that can reap all the rewards from locking people in.
Right. Coming back a little bit, time frame, I'm not sure if we have solved this completely. So you are now collecting members that would like to participate. Then you try to apply for funding, and then you try to start implementing this. What is the time horizon or the time frame that you're aiming there, and how big do you expect it to be? I mean, in principle, you are, well, looks like around 20 organizations, maybe even more, roughly speaking.
A little more now, but yeah, then yeah. 20 is actually the number on the website right now.
Okay, all right. And do you think it will stay in this way, or do you expect many more? Could you imagine more that potentially could join? What is the plan? What is the dimension of that?
So I think right now we're still accepting new members, and we're in a very preparatory phase, and we have to kind of feel out in which direction will it go, right? Will it stop at maybe 40 organizations and a very defined scope, or will it go on to become larger than that? One of the things that I'm always trying to establish is that we have a certain scope, right? And that's user interfaces and user-facing services, because that's how people interact with open science. And that's, I think, the part that's mostly neglected at the moment. And that we really try to provide innovative products as soon as possible, so that, you know, this doesn't become a talking club, but really a club of doers, and that also is able to do things in a timely fashion. But that requires also then, of course, funding, and there are some other things that need to happen for that. So yeah, but this is basically the idea and the plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it might be time to come back to the beginning where we actually started from, because this one thing that you mentioned in the very beginning is that it is really, really important that whoever deals with the future research infrastructure, especially with the digital research infrastructure in the future, and whoever comes up with solutions for this this area, needs to specifically worry about something like interfaces. And I would also include usability. And you mentioned that it is extremely hard to pull people away from current tools that they are using that are not according to these standards that you would like to work off, because they are commercial, because they are not within their control and their power. This will be, I think, a very, very difficult task, because there's one decisive difference in between a commercial vendor of scientific software and a, let's call it, public vendor. The commercial vendor has to sell its product. So they will do the best they can to make the experience, the user experience, as highly as possible. And I think we have all seen in the last years, decades maybe, that some of the public or some of the tools that have been provided by public organizations in the best interests of all have lacked specifically this focus on user experience and usability and interface design, etc. So what could be a working like an approach, at least, to start off on the right foot with regard to this issue?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it's important to find use cases where the existing infrastructure doesn't work as well. So we, for example, did a preliminary survey, at least among students and researchers. And there we found that only a third of people are actually satisfied with the literature search tools that they have at hand right now. So there seems to be a certain demand for better discoverability and findability of research. And then we modeled a use case around a young researcher who wants to get an overview of a specific topic, right? And this was basically the starting point for Open Knowledge Maps. And we stuck to that use case, and we always very closely listened to our users. And that's how we managed to get more than 500,000 users in 2.5 years. And I think that this is really also what needs to be done at a general level. And to really create use cases, user stories, and then to very closely listen to your users' feedback. And I think on the other side, on the funding side, this really needs to be a big part of the evaluation afterwards, right? So to also have a usability evaluation and take the results of that usability evaluation into account to see how many users are on the platform, how engaged are they, and so on. And I think this should be basically the majority of the evaluation. There are other factors, of course, that always need to be taken into account, but there really needs to be a shift in focus. Otherwise, I don't think that this will happen. But we have seen in history that there is a chance for tools to go the whole way when they find these kind of use cases that are so important. Mm. Because I think when Firefox first became really popular, it was because of tabbed browsing. And Internet Explorer didn't have tabbed browsing. And this was a usability, a user interface feature advantage that really a lot of people wanted to have. And that was one of the big things why Firefox became so popular. And this is really, we really need to provide not only the same, but really a better experience and a better performance. And that's, I think, when we can really compete with the commercial vendors. But of course, that's always also a question of money.
Yeah, I don't want to open up a too large side channel, but especially as you have this background, as you have with Open Knowledge Maps, exactly such a tool that has a very different way of exploring literature. And maybe you can quickly, and I know this is very hard in an audio medium only, maybe shortly describe the differences or the way Open Knowledge Maps are constituted and how they work and how you got to this interface, right? You said a lot of user feedback, but maybe you can describe this a little bit in more detail.
Yeah, sure. So the way Open Knowledge Maps works at the moment is you go to a website, openknowledgemaps.org, and you type in a research topic that you're interested in, for example, digital education or something else that you're currently working on. And what we then do is that we pull the most relevant papers from either BASE or PubMed, and we create a clustered overview of that topic. So that means that there are bubbles which represent sort of the subtopics of the topic that you typed in. So for example, for digital education, it's then technology or digital competences, digital literacy, and so on. And then we append to each of the bubbles relevant resources, relevant papers. And when you then zoom into the different bubbles, you can immediately read them within the same interface. So the idea really is to give you an overview, an introduction to a topic that goes way beyond what a list representation can do for you.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get to this interface? Was it just one idea, or did it grow stepwise? What was kind of the evolution, or maybe the revolution that happened to get from zero to the current interface?
So it's basically something that came out of my PhD. And the basic concept that has been around for a long time. The first papers were published in the 1970s. And if you look at the representation there, it doesn't look that different from how Open Knowledge Maps looks today. And there were many different systems that tried to implement this idea over the years. Our focus was always very strongly on the user experience, and we also took cognitive science into account. So we don't want to overload the user and really make it a very useful experience for them. And if I were to guess, I think these were the deciding factors. Coupled together, of course, that we do a lot of workshops, a lot of sessions where we get feedback from our users that we then put back into Open Knowledge Maps. Also via the online channels, we get a lot of feedback and input.
It was actually funny because I mean, you have been working on this project for a very long time now, starting with your PhD, maybe even before. And I mean, we have known you for quite a while now too, so we have kind of been able to look upon the progress of that finally led to the open knowledge maps. And at the very beginning, I remember that I don't know if we have actually talked about it already in an Open Science Radio episode.
I think
We have, at least for a number of times.
Yeah, we have for sure.
But I don't know if we talked about this issue, because I remember myself thinking about, okay, the knowledge graph as kind of the engine behind this kind of systematics that supports serendipity in exploring and discovering new in this case, items of interest that could be publications, other research projects, etc., is kind of a very useful way in research, because that is basically appealing to one of the characteristics of a scientist, being curious about things, wanting to explore and to discover new things. And then it turned out that you were actually going for the visual approach of a knowledge graph with these bubbles that are somehow connected. And I remember clearly that I thought, if that's going to work, if somebody's actually using that, because at the same time while you were looking into it, there was like a small strand of research going on in the US that try to use the visual knowledge graph to describe debates, public debates, so to speak. And that one was, this project was kind of hyped in the beginning, but after like half a year, that was slowly coming to an end, to a very awful end. And it was really surprising for me to see that actually open knowledge maps grew constantly in people who were using this tool and seemed to like this visual approach of kind of being able to find your way through a landscape of research topics. And that was really, really surprising to me. But it was a fun fact to actually see that I was totally wrong. Luckily.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are different types of users out there, right? And for some, the visual approach may always be the wrong one, right? I'm not saying that this is really for 100% of the people and they will all like it. But I think there are a lot of visual types out there, and it's really, for me, it's really a process that really started when the Open Knowledge Maps team came together, mm-hmm. right? Because I had a static prototype of the visualization, and then I thought, oh, it would be cool to make it a dynamic visualization and kind of have all this user input and user engagement. And so I put out a first proposal and said, if there are people who want to work on this, you know, then we can together apply for the Open Science Prize, which was out there back then, and we can create something of it. And to my surprise, more than 15 people responded to this request. And I said, yeah, that's an interesting idea. Let's work on it. And then it really became something that a team of people now took into their hands, among them very gifted software developers, but also designers and people who came from the user side. And this is where it really started to grow into something that had the potential in the end. So I think it was really this open process that also gathered then voices from the outside that created open knowledge maps. And funnily enough, the kind of founding point for open knowledge maps was when we didn't get the Open Science Prize, right? When we were denied the funding because that's, I went into our online chat and I said, I'm sorry, we didn't get it. And everybody else said, well, that's sad, but when do we finally start building this thing? And so we actually did this completely unfunded for the longest time. But it's because we had this kind of shared understanding of we wanted to build. And we had already so much good feedback from the outside, from people who said, oh, I would totally use this, that it kind of became this self-supporting circle or this self-supporting process.
And I mean, coming back from the general topic, I mean, you also said, okay, this is not 100%, you're not aiming for 100% coverage of audience, right? There might be alternatives. And exactly this open infrastructure would exactly facilitate that, right? That you can easily develop different interfaces to similar, to the same data sets. And by that, giving different perspectives to this and addressing different users. And yeah, so this is really the strength of the whole initiative, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we also want to contribute back and contribute the data structures and the graphs that we create in the back. We want to contribute that back to the infrastructure. And then people can build, you know, whatever they want on top of it. Maybe they want to have a graph-based interface, which is maybe then more of an expert tool, or they want to have maybe something that's more simple and that's more akin to the list-based representation. But I agree, yes, with Google Scholar, I think the list-based representation doesn't work for me, but I cannot do anything about it. But with the open infrastructure, you actually can.
Would this be even something for, let's say, educational projects that you say, okay, you have a nice interface and you can simply program your own search interface for it? Have you thought in this direction already, or is this on the agenda?
It's definitely something that's kind of on our long-term plan. We have had initial interest from the education community, also around open educational resources, but we're a very small and really underfunded organization, so we need to focus on certain things, and we're definitely going to focus on scientific knowledge, I think, for now. And should the opportunity arise, then I think we're happy to go into the educational space. But I also think in order to really serve a community, you need to be understanding of their problems, of the workings. And for this, at the moment, we simply don't have the resources. But of course, everybody can take the Open Knowledge Map software and just start building, right? I mean, that's also the beauty of open source. If you have an open educational resources search engine, then you can actually take our software, create your own connector, and build your own Open Knowledge Maps for OERs.
Yeah, Peter, I have now a big problem. A huge firework of ideas is currently popping up in my brain. So we have to talk later again. It might take 5 hours, so we don't have to give this to the listeners here. But maybe they will hear at some point about this. No, just some crazy ideas popping up here.
So yeah, just to add something that you were very nicely circumventing. You said it that the whole software is open source available, and you even came up with a whole framework for, I think, web-based knowledge maps that that everybody can just fork and adapt on towards his own parameters.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So this is called the Head Start framework, and you can find it via a link on our website, openknowledgemaps.org. And it also has some tutorials on how to get started with the software. I wouldn't necessarily claim that at this point it's very easy to get into it, but there are definitely a lot of friendly people who are willing to help you with this.
Mm-hmm. some of which we have actually met over the years on various occasions, such as the Barcamp Open Science. And we will also not only link all the stuff in the show notes that we mentioned, but also link a number of episodes, for example, with you. I think it was 65, where you spent like a quarter of an hour with us to explain the current status of the Open Knowledge Map. And I think we had, what was his name? Asura, on one of the barcamps as a short interview partner. So we'll link all this stuff.
Exactly. It's not that you are a stranger to us. Yeah. Peter, have we forgotten anything or anything that should be addressed here?
No, I think just on the notion of the team, I especially want to thank Maxi and Chris, who are with me in the board of Open Knowledge Maps and who are now really driving this initiative together with me and doing so for the most part on a volunteer basis. So yeah, this is basically just to also thank them and the whole team for sticking with Open Knowledge Maps, believing in this idea and really shaping it over the years.
Maybe to be the devil's advocate, after you have so nicely thanked your team members, you have actually, and this is coming back to the very beginning, where Konrad already mentioned that you have given a number of talks over the last couple of weeks. What is the feedback that you get on your talks? Because you're not holding back. I mean, you're still argumenting in a very, very nice and diplomatic way, but you're not holding back in terms of showing what the problem is. What is the general feedback? And did you have feedback from somebody like Google or similar vendors?
Yeah, to your second question, yes, exactly. There was a tweet that started the whole "Don't Leave It to Google" campaign, and basically a Googler responded to this tweet and pointed out the metadata format that they are using, and this is basically an open format, right, that you can implement on your website, and then Google Dataset Search will find the dataset and add it to the index. And he pointed out that schema.org, the name of the metadata format, that this is the open part. And I think that's at the moment what's happening with the commercial vendors. They're really trying to divert, right, and say, oh, you know, we're part of some working group where we're also contributing to some of the open formats. And they're trying to kind of hide the fact that all the other infrastructure that they're building is closed and proprietary. And I don't think that's not by chance, because they now want to sell all of their products to the universities, and they're approaching them right now with kind of one-stop-shop turnkey solutions that will lock these institutions into their systems forever. And so I think that there, and this also now relates to the feedback that I'm getting on the talks, I think there is a growing understanding that this is a pivotal point right now. So I think within the next 2 or 3 years, a lot of these things will be settled, right? Because then either there will be enough open infrastructure and people will using it, or enough institutions will have bought the kind of closed proprietary solutions. So I think that at this point, there's a lot of understanding, but I also get a lot of questions, and I think there's still a lot of ground that we need to cover in order for everyone to really have this kind of understanding of why user interfaces and user-facing services are so important. Mm.
May I extend one of your points? Because of your points, if Google comes to a university and offers this, people, this is strange to them, right? But unfortunately, also other providers, namely publishers, right, that are, let's say, have closer bounds to universities and libraries, if they come, they might even have it easier to step into that, right? And there's a lot of stuff happening right now. And just as a add on this, so even those guys are coming into, you're completely right, because if you have once signed that and you have all your data and these kind of things in there, it's very hard to migrate into another place. It's a similar thing with electronic lab notebooks. One thing that is currently super sexy topic, everybody would like to have electronic lab notebooks. Once you signed there and you have your data in this kind of stuff, it will hardly get out of this. And they know that. And there are no open standards migrating from one electronic lab notebook provider to another one. They maybe some have their own XML format, but this will not be easily integrated into another system. So this is really, sorry for stressing this now, but this is really a crucial time that we're in where a lot of this stuff is happening. Everybody's talking about the digital turn, but not everybody is aware of the long-term consequences that their decisions have. And this is why I would love to have this in as many heads as possible. Think open there, because this will be, there will be no easy way getting out of this once you decide it.
Yeah, absolutely. And building on that, we should also take into account then all of the user data is with these commercial entities or the algorithms. So in essentially what your researchers see is controlled by this commercial entity. And there is no governance over these systems, right? There's a lot of talk about governance, for example, in the EOSC and in other parts of the open infrastructure. But when it comes to these user interfaces and these user-facing services, at the moment, we don't really have any governance over them. And there is nothing that prevents, for example, Elsevier or Digital Science to always prefer their own systems and their own content when they show something to your researchers. So I think it's really important to take these things into account.
So we can just repeat our mantra that we have here in Open Science Radio and the open science community, I would say. Clearly my disclaimer, yes, I'm working in a library basically and doing research here, but also we are a service provider and exactly doing knowledge discovery and doing data management. This is, in my opinion, the place where this kind of stuff should end up, or in general repositories. But the connection between science and the libraries should be strengthened, and there you have control regarding who's doing what with your data, the algorithms, and all this kind of thing. So we have to strengthen this connection again. And also initiatives like yours are a very important foundation for long-term control, for the guarantee that the data is accessible in a way that we want it and that it's open. So this is why it's very close to our heart, strengthening this here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we see libraries as a strong partner. We build on library content through Base, and we don't restrict, for example, the kinds of artifacts that you can see in Open Knowledge Maps. So it also can take up the special collections that libraries have, and we don't restrict language, for example. So I think there is a lot of common ground and already a lot of collaboration, and I hope to see that blossoming and becoming bigger in the future.
Great. So I guess we are at the end. Peter, so much thanks for all the details that you gave us here and all the answers that you gave us here. Matthias, do you have anything to add?
Yes, of course. I'm making before also thanking Peter. I'm just adding a very short note for anybody who's in Berlin next week, specifically on Wednesday. There will be a discussion hosted by our friends at Wikimedia Germany. I think it's even within their space. That is related to this topic. The question is whether we can, or which kind of infrastructure is actually necessary in order to provide for an open and transparent and good science. And there's three discussion partners, one actually being you, Conrad, and the other two are Professor Ellen Euler from one of the Potsdam universities. Professor Christian Sprang, who is somebody from, I don't even know how to explain this, from an organization that is called Börsenverein des Deutschen Buchhandels. And I'm not going into explaining what the Börsenverein des Deutschen Buchhandels is.
It's complicated, yeah.
But I will link it in the show notes. And it starts in the evening. I will link to the discussion page at Wikimedia for any details. It's still open. There's enough space for participants. So whoever is in Berlin at that day and wants to join the discussion about this infrastructural aspects, feel free to go there. If you can't have the chance, it's very likely that you will hear the whole discussion afterwards here, specifically with us, because I think we're going to record it anyway.
That's the plan, exactly. I'm really looking forward to the discussion and hope many of you show up there and support the discussion and try to put their opinions into this as well.
Mm-hmm. We have had in the last episode, which is like only 8 minutes long, we have had Christopher from Wikimedia giving a bit more background about this, why this discussion is taking place. So if you haven't heard it so far and want to know a bit more about it, I'll link it in the show notes. And that finally leads us to the end.
Yeah, well, we have to mention that the discussion will be in English. This is maybe the one thing that's that was not clear so far, and this is also why the announcement by in the previous episode is in English, is in German as well. Yeah, but now the end. Yeah. So thank you very much, Peter. It was great having you here again, and I'm pretty sure this won't be the last time we have the opportunity to talk to you here in front of the microphone. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation and the great discussion.
Great.
Good. Then, hear you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.